So this week is Parshas Bahalos. Now that we are past Shavuos, actually a week and a half past Shavuos. A week past Shavuos. Shavuos was a week ago. It's going so fast. And Parshas Bahalos is really the beginning of the end for the Jewish people, if you will. Parshas Bahalos is really a crossroads for the Jewish people in this week's Parsha. This is where their descent begins from their very high level. They were supposed to go straight into the land of Israel and live happily ever after. And instead, things start to go sour around the midway point of this week's parasha. And it culminates in the sin of the spies next week. At that point, God says that the Jewish people will be in the desert for 40 years. Now, just to show you how far this goes, this idea that there's like a crossroads over here for the Jewish people, the Talmud has a very interesting discussion where the Talmud says, and even though we typically say there are five books in the Torah, the Talmud says that there are actually seven books in the Torah. You never heard that one before, right? Okay. Now, we know the number seven is very popular in Judaism. Seven is always the completeness of the natural world. But why seven? We have five. And that's what you've always heard. And that's what you will continue to hear. So where did seven books come from? So the Talmud says that we have a very famous a few verses over here that talk about Vayihi ben Tsoa Ha'aron, when the ark would travel through the desert. If you ever go to a synagogue, when they take out the Torah scroll, what do they recite? Vayihi ben Tsoa Ha'aron, Vayomer Moshe. Right? That's what they recite. Marsha, that's what they recite.
Okay, you can say something.
Okay. That's what they say. And that is actually verses. How are you? These are actually verses. Okay, these are actually verses from this week's parasha where the Torah talks about that the travels of the Jewish people in the desert. And if you look in the Torah scroll, there's a very strange thing in there. There is an upside-down letter Nun before these verses and another upside-down letter Nun after these verses. And the Talmud says, why are these upside-down Nuns here? There's a lot of discussion. And one approach is that the book of Bamidbar until this point is one book. And the book of, and then that section, those verses are a second book. And then everything thereafter till the end is a third book. So we just took one book of the Torah and split it into three. Now, obviously, we're not splitting it into three in the classic sense, that it's a totally separate book. We treat it as one book of Bamidbar. But clearly the Talmud is telling us that this idea that I just shared a few minutes ago, that there is sort of a juncture over here, a cutoff between the first part of the book of Bamidbar, where everything's hunky-dory, okay, the first two parshas, Bamidbar and Nasa, the beginning of Baal Oscha, where the Torah talks about how the Jews traveled in the desert and how they encamped and so on and so forth, and talks about the sanctity of the camp and all these things. Some other things get in there as well. And then Hashem talks about the role of the Levites and the Kohanim and so on. Then you have this little section in middle, talking about the travels of the ark through the desert. And then you have the rest of the book where things start to go not so well for the Jewish people. They leave Mount Sinai. They start traveling. They start complaining. Things go downhill pretty quickly. Okay?
Yeah.
They sure did.
And they took it with them, but they were still bitching.
Yes.
Right?
About the food. They were not happy with the food.
Well, we don't like that.
Jews always kvetch. They don't like the food. So we really started over here. But they were taken to task for kvetching about the food. Now, we have to understand something. If you ever hear, you know, some people, when they discuss the stories in the Torah, they're very busy putting these great people into their shoes. Okay, and so what they do is they take great people of the likes of the patriarchs, Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, or the Jewish people in the desert who were very great people. Think about it. They heard God talk to them. Okay, today, very few people can claim that. Those who do are usually in certain types of hospitals and things like that, and so on. For God to talk to someone, it's not just like, you know, it's often portrayed as you're walking down the block and suddenly, you know, you have this enormous tap on your shoulder. And, you know, the Lord talks to you and so on. No, it doesn't work that way. For God to talk to a person, the person has to be on the level for God to talk to him. Okay. On the contrary, people like Bilam, who were a very wicked person, whom God communicated with, there's a lot of discussion. How could God communicate with someone of that nature? But in general, to be a prophet, you've got to reach a very high spiritual level. And the Jewish people heard God talk to them at Sinai. And yet people today have no problem taking these great giants and throwing them on their couch and psychoanalyzing them as if, you know, they're some regular person today who's walking the street. And, you know, it's besides being a very insensitive and a ridiculous thing to do, because you're talking about people who are in a totally different league. How can you analyze them and try to figure out their motives and so on your own? It also smacks of enormous hubris to go ahead and do that, you know, to sit there analyzing these people. So, you know, beyond what we are told by our sages about understanding the motives behind these actions, we really don't have a right to try to psychoanalyze these people and what their motives were and so on. But getting back to my subject over here. So on that, I'm sorry, before I get back to my subject, but just to conclude what you triggered over here, Marcia, is that although people like to say that the Jews spend all their time in the desert kvetching, the reality is, if you look, Jews were in the desert for 40 years. 40 years. Over the course of 40 years, they screwed up a grand total of 10 times. 10 times they messed up over the course of 40 years. That's not bad. Okay, it's not bad at all. 10 times over the course of 40 years, they messed up. Most people, mess up 10 times in the span of a single day, or are kvetching, you know, quite a lot in the span of a single day. And here you have 10 times that they complain to God, usually about valid things. There's no water. You know, they complain there's no water. Now, what happens to you when the water gets shut off in your house? Imagine having no water for 3 days in your middle of the desert. God told you to go here. And he didn't tell you when it's going to turn back on either. Okay? You would kvetch also to someone, to God, or to the water company or whatever. You would, you know, rant and rave and rail at the unfairness of it all. And so on. So, people are going crazy because of inflation. Now, I'm not saying that it's not the end of the world. It is pretty close to it, because of the inflation and so on. But, you know, $5 a gallon of gas, you know, but you've got gas. At least you can get gas. Imagine living in the desert. It's like, okay, what are we having for food today? Oh, we're having the manna again for 40 years. So the Jewish people got tired of having the manna. And there was reason for their complaint. Now, because of their level, there was a problem with what they did and what they said and so on and so forth. Complaining about the food was not appropriate at their level to do that. So they were taken to task. Okay, but we have to keep in mind, they were talking about very great people over here, whose errors, while they might seem to us very crass, were in fact very subtle mistakes. When you stop and think about it, they were in fact really not that big of a deal in the bigger picture. But because they were so great, God had big expectations of them. And therefore, those seemingly minute failures ended up being massive failures. As we've often pointed out, the greater a person is, the higher the expectations are, and the less room for error there is in that person's position. Okay, if you have a person very low down on the corporate totem pole who walks out on the street and makes a statement about the company or his opinion about the company or whatever it is, no one really is going to care very much. If the CEO gets up and has some comments about the company that are not in line with, that don't toe the line of the company, he might be looking for a new position very quickly. Why? Because the CEO, even one little mistake, you know, is a major deal. And for the little guy, for the grunt down on the bottom of the totem pole, who cares? So whatever, you know, he messed up or something like that. One, you know, he made an error. It's not a big deal. The CEO makes an error. It was just a small error. Yeah, but that small error can have catastrophic consequences. So the greater you are, the higher the expectations. So I had a question on Zoom. No? Okay. And we will continue. While I'm at it, I'm just going to mute everyone so we don't have to worry about background noise. And if someone has a question, they can unmute, as always. Okay, so let's get into the, yes.
All these people were in an elevated level, right?
Yes, all these people were on an elevated level.
With direct communication to Hashem.
So they, after Sinai, they did not communicate directly with Hashem. I mean, there were prophets among them. But, you know, the average Jew was not a prophet in the desert. They had a level of prophecy at Sinai for a time.
But they had an understanding of Hashem, so that they really didn't need to ask silly questions like the man changed its taste every
right.
day. So why would they complain about
it? Okay, it's a good question. Maybe we'll discuss that. Yes. That's a good reason to complain. Yes.
At this point in time, did people die natural deaths? How many of the original
yes.
people that left Egypt were still alive 40 years later?
Well, once we have the sin of the spies, part of the punishment was God said you'll be in the desert for 40 years, and all those who left Egypt between the age of 20 and 60 will perish on their 60th when they turn 60. So every year, not on the day of their birthday, but on Tisha B'Av every year, on the 9th of Av, which was the anniversary of the sin of the spies, anyone who had turned 60 that year would actually dig a hole in the ground and go and lie down in it and not wake up the next morning. And this is what went on every year. So they knew every year for those 40 years when they turned 60 that they were not going to wake up the next morning. Yeah.
I'm sorry. In the parsha, they talk a lot about the last two parshas, the Kohen by Dovin and Levi's level. Levi's, but they don't talk about
Testaments. The Torah does not talk only about the Levites and the Kohanim. It talks quite a bit about all the Jewish people. In Parashas Bamidbar, the Torah speaks quite a length about all the Jewish people.
But they just don't label them.
They are, how would you like them labeled?
I don't know.
Miscreants? I'm like, what do you want them labeled? It's that they are, each member belongs to his tribe. The Torah counts, goes through every tribe. The Torah says this is how many people were in each tribe. And it goes through great detail how many people are in each tribe. Okay. What else do you want?
That's my understanding.
No, I'm asking what else, you know. Yeah, the Torah does go into detail a lot about the Levites because the tribe of Levi had a unique role to play in the construction, in the destruction or taking down, and the transportation of the Mishkan. And the Kohanim had jobs in the Mishkan. So it talks at great length about those roles and those jobs. Because they do occupy a unique space within the Jewish people, as they do today. Not to the same degree, because we don't have a temple. But even today, is a mitzvah to give special honor to a Kohen. Not to a Levi, but to a Kohen. Okay, that's one of the reasons why the Kohen always gets called up for the first Aliyah, and the Torah is read, followed by a Levi. You know, you give them first dibs, and then you move on to the rest of us. Okay? Okay, so yeah, you know, if anyone tells you that there's no hierarchy within the Jewish nation. It's not true. There is a hierarchy in the Jewish nation. I don't know if you want to give it that term, a caste system per se. On the flip side, it's important to remember that a basic part of Jewish belief is that it doesn't matter what you're born into, as they say, yichus or lineage is very nice, but you've got to do something with it. And so the Talmud makes the point that a mamzer who is child born of an incestuous or adulterous relationship, though starting off really at the bottom of the totem pole within the Jewish people, the Talmud says that a mamzer who's a Torah scholar is on a higher level than a Kohen Gadol who's an ignoramus. Okay? So there's no question that anyone has the opportunity to advance their spiritual standing through their efforts, even if they're born at a lower spiritual standing. So you have both things are true. Okay? And at the end of the day, when we talk about different levels of spiritual standing, that's all for this world. In the next world, a person is judged solely on his or her accomplishments with what he or she was given in this life. Okay? So if a person is born, let's just say, into a very prestigious family with great lineage and so on and so forth, and he just kind of floats along his whole life and just does what he needs to do to maintain the family status, but doesn't really go above and beyond to advance his own spiritual standing, then he's in for a rude surprise in the next world, because with all his lineage and all of his prestige in this world, but that came to him automatically. Doesn't get much. You don't get much for that. Whereas the person who pulled himself up or herself by her bootstraps, you know, and advanced themselves, I'm talking about spiritually over here, you know, through good old hard work and choosing the right things and so on, will be in a much better place. So at the end of the day, up in heaven, in the next world, it depends on what you accomplish through your own efforts. But in this world, we do live with the reality of a hierarchy and different social strata and spiritual strata within the Jewish people. That is absolutely true. Yeah.
Tribe that you're in this world that can change when you go
there? No, you don't change tribes. You don't change a tribe. But in terms of what you will get in the next world is not predicated on your tribe. It's predicated on you, what you accomplished in this world. If I work for a company and the boss gives me $1 million and sends me on a business trip and says, go make some money, go invest it, whatever, and I come back a year later and I have the same $1 million, the boss is going to fire me.
Well, you didn't lose any, right?
Which company do you work for? So, you know, if the idea is to go ahead and invest it and make money, if I give my let me make it more basic. If I give my money to an investment manager and I'm paying him money to do this, and he comes back to me after a year and says, "Here's what you got, exactly the same amount you gave me." Let's assume the market is up, okay? And he says, you gave me $1 million? Here's $1 million back. I'm finding a different investment manager. What do you mean? The market went up. Why didn't I have money? I didn't lose any. Yeah, but that's what you started with. I didn't give you the money to give me back what I gave you. I put it in a savings account. You made 0.001%. Maybe now it's a drop more because interest rates went up. If only savings account rates went up along with the gas prices, we'd be in good shape. So. Someone said that that cocaine is now cheaper than gas. So just give everyone cocaine and they can run wherever they have to get to. okay. I'm not, by the way, that was not an endorsement. Please. All right. So you have to deal with what you're given. You have to bring returns. So imagine if God puts a person into this world, puts him into a very prestigious Torah family with great lineage and everything, and he goes to Cheder from when he's 3 months old, and he's studying, and he's brilliant, and he's got his father and his grandfather and his grandmother and everything, and they're studying with him, and he knows the whole Torah and so on and so forth. But this is all just, you know, ingrained. That's what he was given on a silver platter. You know, he's born with that proverbial silver spoon in his mouth in a spiritual sense. And he comes up to God after 120, and God says, what'd you do? He says, well, I studied the whole Talmud. I went to the best schools. I became a Rosh Hashiva. And God says, yeah, but that was handed to you in a silver platter. You were born into that. What did you do with your life? I gave you $1 million. What returns do you have to show me? No. And then the other guy comes up, and he says, God says, what'd you do? I studied one page of Talmud my whole life. So the guy says, one page of Talmud. And God says, you go straight into heaven. So the other guy says, what are you talking about? He says, well, he came from nowhere. He spent, you know, his whole life moving himself forward and growing so he could study one page of Talmud. Right? You know the story of the rabbi and the rabbi and the bus driver who come up to heaven after 120? You know the story? Okay, you'll know the story in a minute. A rabbi and a bus driver come up to heaven after 120 years. I'm never going to get to my main point of today's class. This is a good story, Marcia. Okay. A rabbi and a bus driver come up to heaven at 120. No, I did not see the story firsthand. And the rabbi led his flock faithfully for decades throughout his life. And the bus driver drove a bus for decades throughout his life, but it wasn't a particularly spiritually advanced individual. The heavenly court, tells the rabbi, okay, hang on, we got to look things over, we got to see how you did, you know, and so on and so forth. So, you know, hang on. And the bus driver walks up and he says, okay, you go straight into heaven, straight into Gan Eden. So the rabbi says, excuse me, I'm a rabbi. I studied Torah my whole life. I faithfully led my flock, dealt with everyone's problems and so on. And the bus driver, who was not a particularly advanced person, goes straight into heaven. He said, rabbi, when you spoke, everyone slept. When he drove, everyone prayed. Okay, so there you go. I told you it's a good one, right? Okay, had to be an Israeli bus driver. Okay, so there you go. You never know. You never know. The bottom line is you never know really what a person's worth. You never really know what a person's worth in this world. You can have the biggest Rosh Hashiva in the world, and you know, and you should give him honor. He's a Torah scholar. He's a leader of, and he should get honor in this world. That doesn't mean that in heaven he's worth more than the bus driver. Not for that reason, that the joke, you know, but whatever it is, everyone's got their job and everyone has to, what is the return on investment that I'm getting? How much did God invest with me and what am I returning? So it's a scary prospect because we you know, the way the world works is that we tend to look at things as, you know, superficially. And that's just the nature of the world. And we have to apply ourselves to that world and deal with it. Yes, rich people get honor, and they should. You know, people who know a lot of Torah get honor, and they should get honor. But does that mean that spiritually they're worth more than the guy over there up in heaven? Will he get a better Olam Haba? Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Okay, so let's talk about this manna business because it was brought up. So I want to focus on that. I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about. But because you brought up the manna and people complaining about the taste, we're going to talk about that. The Jewish people... Yeah.
Real quick. So when the Jews...
Ethel, I'm going to try... I will try to repeat the question. Yes.
When the Jews were in the desert and Moses went up to get the Ten Commandments, came down and there was the golden calf.
Right.
Then how long did it take them to get to the point of where the spies...
Okay.
Story?
So a quick timeline off the top of my head, if I can remember it. Do you want to know... just for the audience online, I'm going to repeat the question. Marshall wants to know from when the Torah was given until the sin of the spies. What's the timeline? Very quickly, the Jewish people got the Torah on Shavuos, which is actually a dispute if it was the sixth or seventh of Sivan, but let's just keep things simple. The sixth day of the month of Sivan, which was last week, Sunday. And then Moshe went up and he came down on the 17th of Tammuz with the Luchos with the tablets, Ten Commandments, and lo and behold, the Jewish people are worshiping the golden calf. He smashes it. Long story short, Moshe shuttles back and forth between God and the Jewish people, trying to patch things up. Okay, he goes up again to God, prays that he not destroy the Jewish people. He goes up another time for 40 days and prays, and God says, okay, I won't destroy them. But our relationship is broken. And Moshe comes back down, tells the Jewish people, okay, you're not being destroyed, but, you know, the relationship is messed up. Jewish people are very distraught. Moshe goes back up another 40 days on starting the first day of Elul and prays for God to fully forgive the Jewish people and to renew the relationship. Meanwhile, the Jewish people are down below engaging in repentance and penance and regret and all that stuff, which is the whole month of Elul through Rosh Hashanah until Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, God says 40 days later, I forgive the Jewish people. And that day is Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement. That's why we do it, because that's the day that God said, I will forgive. And that's why we have 40 days from Elul. You have Elul through Yom Kippur, 40 days. That was the process of the Jewish people and their teshuva, their repentance from the sin of the golden calf. So that was that. That was on Yom Kippur. Then by the following Nisan, the Mishkan was put up. Construction on the Mishkan, gathering of materials began on Sukkot, a few days after Yom Kippur. It was ready, actually, to be put up on Hanukkah. God said, don't put it up now. Wait till Nisan, because Nisan is a very, very auspicious month. Hanukkah complained and said, excuse me, but it's ready to be put up now. God said, there'll be another holiday when they will rededicate the temple to pay you back. And that's the holiday of Hanukkah, which is the rededication of the temple. That's kind of like payback for that. And they were at Mount Sinai, I think for another year or so. And the Torah says exactly what day they left, when they left Mount Sinai and started their trek towards the land of Israel. I don't have it in front of me, but it was, a year and change later that they actually left Mount Sinai and started their trek towards the land of Israel. In 11 days, they crossed through the desert and came to the border of the land of Israel. They were supposed to go in. They said, hold on, before we go in, let's send scouts, spies. God said, this is not going to end well, but you asked for it. Go ahead. And they send spies, and the spies come back on Erev Tisha B'Av. And on the night of Tisha B'Av, they give their evil report. The people cry the whole night. God said, you cried without reason on this night. As my father used to tell me, I will give you a reason to cry. And that's exactly what God did. And that's the night of Tisha B'Av, which we'll have to talk about maybe next week if we have a class. Okay. So.
Why the Jewish people didn't want to go into Israel?
That's next week. We're not talking about that this week. I'll never get to what I want to talk about. So let's talk about the manna, because we've been all over the place today. There is a lot of talk about what to talk about over there. Okay. But it's not for this week. So why are they complaining about the manna? The Jewish people in this week's parasha, finally, let's get to our main subject. The Jewish people in this week's parasha complain about the manna. And they say, all we have, they call this accursed bread. No, I'm sorry. Long parasha, that's later. But they complain about the man, and they say, all you have to eat is manna. We're sick of it. We don't want to eat it. We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt, and the garlic, and the leeks, and the watermelons, and the cucumbers. you know, ask a person who's like on a strict diet, what do you miss? Cucumbers. Man, I just can't manage to have those cucumbers. Why? I got to put them in my eyes. No, but like really, what was, now the manna, as you pointed out, tasted like whatever you wanted it to taste like. So the question is, first of all, Rabbi Moshe Shapiro was the greatest Jewish thinker of our era, passed away a few years ago. He points out that when a kid hears this idea, the Mora tells him in kindergarten, you know, the mun tastes like whatever you wanted it to taste like. You just had to think, and it tastes like whatever you want. You want the pizza? Pizza. He says, you think it's like a Baskin Robbins. You walk in, and there's, what is it, 64 flavors? Look how many flavors I got over here. What should I choose today? And they think, like, the man is like this ice cream parlor. What flavor should I choose? It's a very crass picture. Obviously, there's much more spiritual depth going on over here. Why didn't the manna taste like these foods that they complain about? It doesn't taste like onion. It does not taste like leeks, garlic, cucumbers, watermelon. There's one more thing I'm missing over there. Maybe onions. And remember, why does it taste like those foods? Says Rashi, because these foods are bad for a nursing mother. Okay. Keep in mind that whatever a mother eats goes to the kid, right? So these foods, says Rashi, are bad for a nursing mother, for the child. And therefore, God does not want the Jewish people to eat these foods. What is one thing I have to do with the other? Because they're bad for a nursing mother, and therefore the Jewish people can't eat these foods. The answer is, listen to this answer. Maybe now we'll try to understand what exactly is going on with the Jewish people over here, why they're complaining. The Talmud says that, well, I shouldn't say the Talmud, the Torah says that the Jewish people in the desert were carried by God like a mother carries her child. In other words, the Jewish people in the desert are like a child nursing from the mother. A mother is nursing a child. The kid's always with the mother, right? Almost always. The mother needs a break, probably. Hopefully the father steps in once in a while to help out, you know, and whatever. But, by the way, one lesson, you know, I learned very, very quickly is never wake up in the morning and say, baby was pretty quiet last night, huh? But anyways, so that was an important lesson I learned early on. The idea is the Jewish people, vis-a-vis Hashem, were like a child with the mother, nursing from the mother all the time. Hashem carried them through the desert, so to speak. Literally, they were on, you know, they were on cloud nine. You know, the clouds were under them, above them, surrounding them, taking care of all their needs. They were like a child nursing from the mother. And consequently, whatever the spiritual problem of these foods are that can cause harm to a child, so God is feeding them the manna. This is like, you'll notice the manna is white, right? Like a mother's milk. White always represents chesed, kindness. You cannot cook meat in milk. Meat is red. Red is din, justice, judgment, restriction, death, blood. Milk is chesed, kindness, nurturing, life. You notice that? You notice that bread is right in between. Bread is like a light brown color. It's not white. It's not red. Bread is the perfect medium between the two. Milk is chesed. It's kindness. We eat dairy foods on Shavuos. The Torah is kindness. It represents the idea of eating dairy, milk, and so on. So the mun is white. It also represents that kindness, that purity, straight from God. The Jewish people cannot have experienced the foods that are harmful to a nursing baby through the manna, because they are that nursing child. So whatever spiritual problem there is with those foods that bothers the child will affect the Jewish people's spiritual standing as well. What are they complaining about? Well, being a nursing baby has a drawback, and that is you have no independence. You have no independence. As a child starts to get older, what does the kid start to do? When a kid's very little, the child is totally dependent on the parent. When a kid gets a little older, when they hit terrible twos, what is the major trigger of what they call terrible twos? Now it's like terrible threes, fours, fives, six, sevens, and eights, whatever. But what triggers it? The child is now starts to be, and this continues like through teenage years in varying degrees. You're caught between two worlds. On the one hand, you want to be independent. You want to do things yourself. If you ever try to buckle a two-year-old into a car seat and the kid insists, she actually absolutely says, I do it myself, and sits there for 5 minutes trying to get the buckle into the thing. And you're like, I gotta go. I have to go. I need to go. So God help you if you try to put that buckle into the snap. It's a full-blown temper tantrum. Why? What's the big deal with the stupid buckle? The answer is, I can do it, and I'm going to show you I can do it. So usually you reach a compromise. Okay, fine, you do it, and you like surreptitiously stick your hand underneath and guide it in, right? The Jewish people are totally reliant on God, and the manna represents that. Okay, and you're right, the food tastes like whatever you want it to taste like, but they're not independent. They're totally reliant on God. The struggle of the Jewish people going on over here constantly is we need God, but we also want to do things on our own. We don't necessarily always want that close, intense relationship all the time. Sometimes the Jews are like, we need a little space. That happens in relationships sometimes. You know, it's great, always together, but sometimes we need a little space. And the Jewish people are struggling with this constantly. And God says, we're going to have this intense, very close relationship. Yeah. We're going to do it. Nasa v'nishma, Sinai, right? Nasa v'nishma, whatever God you want, you are sustaining us. Whatever you say, we will do. We are totally reliant on you. But as life goes on, especially when they move away from Sinai, and Rashi says, the sages say, based on the verses, they left Sinai a little too eagerly. It's like a child leaving school. It's that time of year. You ever watch kids run out of school? On any day, for sure the last day of school, right? They're very happy to leave school. It's been great to learn and stuff, but we're much, you know, now we're independent. Now we can do what we want. We have the whole summer in front of us. So while a child may understand he's better off in school learning stuff, at the end of the day, where is he happier? Being away from school. Ultimately, parent looks and says, you need the structure. You need the education. Go to school. It's better for you. But if you ask the kid, where am I happier? Running away. So the Jewish people simultaneously understand they have this need to be in school, so to speak. They need God. God is sustaining them. They have this close, intense relationship. But at the same time, when they leave Sinai, there's this feeling of, whew, we have a little space. We have a little space. And that process of leaving Sinai is the last step right before that first book I mentioned when we started closes. That first book, first section of the book of Bamidbar ends with the Jewish people leaving Sinai. They're a little too happy about it. Now there's a break. And then the Torah talks about the ark traveling through the desert. And now we continue with the story of the Jewish people in the desert. Now things start to go downhill. You know why? Because the Jewish people said, we need a little space. And from there, things went downhill. And so now the Jewish people come and start complaining about the food, about the manna. Now it was actually the Erev Rav, those semi-sincere converts, not really sincere converts, to the Jewish people who start this process of complaining about the manna, but the rest of the Jewish people are influenced and they jump on board. And they're complaining, all we got to eat is manna. Manna is food straight from heaven. It's straight from God. A major part of their complaint was, we want to live a normal life with normal food. We don't want this nursing experience. It's great. You're right. Tastes like whatever we want to taste like. We have this great spiritual experience is really the deeper idea of what's going on here. Any spiritual experience we want through our food, of trying anything, we get that through the manna. But we want to live a normal life. We want to be independent. We want to move on with things. That's their struggle. And they're struggling with this. But there's a failure over there because, you know, when you're struggling, sometimes you trip. And the Jewish people trip. And they say, we don't want the manna. We want meat. Okay, again, going back. Manna is white, chesed, kindness, God's kindness. The Jewish people say, we want meat. What's meat? Meat is red. Red can connote death, but also the idea of meat is that you take another life, you put it under your control, you dominate it, you remove it, now you can eat the meat. You process it and so on. The process of meat is the process of, in a certain sense, it represents pulling something under my control. If I take milk, milk is sustenance, it's connection. Meat is disconnect. It's taking a life in order to sustain myself. It means I will manage on my own without connection. There's a streak of independence over there. There's a streak of, I'll do things on my own. I don't need God to give me this milk from heaven all the time. I can manage my own. I'll get myself a nice steak. Why not? That's what they want. That's what they're complaining for. That is the beginning of the end for them. And it will culminate with sending a despise where the Jewish people, God says, I'm taking care of everything. And the Jewish people say, maybe we should put in a little effort on our own in conquering this land. Again, you see this struggle. God says, you don't have to do anything. Just sit tight in the back seat and I will drive this ship. You all pray, like we said before with the bus driver. Yeah. It says God, I'm driving the bus. And the Jewish people say, but maybe we should do something ourselves. Put in some effort in conquering this land. Shouldn't we send spies? God says, no, no, it's okay. I'm taking care of everything. You don't have to do anything. And the Jewish people again, but maybe we should do something. Struggle. Do we step in or do we just step back and let God take everything? That struggle keeps repeating itself and it will manifest. God says, you don't trust me. We don't trust you. Of course we trust you. No, no. In other words, God says, I'm taking care of everything. And the Jewish people keep saying, but I want to do it. Like the kid with the buckle. I want to do it, but you can't. You're right. You'll help me, but I want to do something. And God says, so you're not relying totally on me. You want to rely on yourself. You don't put your full faith and trust in me. You think you can do it on your own, or you think you have to do it on your own. And that's where the sin of the spies is going to come crashing in, is where this struggle between relying on God totally versus maybe I need to do something is going to, this is where it's going to come to a head next week's parasha. But you'll have to wait till next week's parasha for that. So practically for us, the reality is this is the struggle of our lives because we always have to, the reality is, and I've mentioned this idea many times, it always comes up. On the one hand, we have to rely on God. At the same time, we have to put in our effort. That constant struggle and tension between putting in my own effort, but at the same time, not forgetting where my success comes from, is this constant struggle. On a different plane, it also has to do with the intensity of the relationship. How willing is a person really to have a very intense relationship with God? On the one hand, it can be very wonderful. On the other hand, it's a little scary, right? In today's world, people are scared to commit, especially men. Very scared to commit to relationships. Okay. This is very often the case. The women, you know, today, I remember when I want to finish up, but early in my career in Denver, I was getting acclimated having left my cocoon, you know, of studying in Kollel in the very Jewish area. So you meet a lot of different types of people. And a fellow Kollel member told me that a chavrusa has said, you know, people express in the world, you mean Orthodox Jews just get married after meeting a few times? You don't like try it out for a few months, living together first before you get married? No, actually, we don't do it. But how do you know it's going to work? Okay, you know, it makes sense. We met, there's chemistry. We get married. We put in the effort and we rely on God that this is going to work. But to live together without marriage. So more often than not, from what I understand, it is usually the woman who's pushing the man to marry more than the man. Very often the man is like pushing off. I'm not ready. The men have a very hard time committing to these relationships. It's scary because the male nature is to just look, what else can I do? Where else can I go? Whom else can I get that's better? And so on. You know, that is, take care. Yeah. Good luck. It shouldn't just be a pipe dream. she's asked to catch the plumber. She's waiting for the plumber to come.
Rabbi?
Up. Yeah. Rabbi? Go ahead.
Because the people are dying off, the new people never said we will do. So they're not ready to accept this anymore.
Okay, so first of all, the people that we're dealing with right now are that original group of people.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Those people who said, you know, who accepted the Torah at Sinai are going to die in the desert after the sin of the spies. At this point, it's still that generation. As far as the second point you make, you know, if what you mean is that future generations, why are they held accountable for the decision of the original? Okay, that's a good question. But on a basic sense, once you're Jewish, you're Jewish. You know, and you know, so once you're born into it, you're kind of bound by those obligations. You're not really given a choice. That choice was made by the Jewish people at that point and passed on to future generations. Relationship is forged. That's it. The relationship is there. Okay. So just in concluding, as I was saying, when you have a relationship, so very often one side, as I said, usually the man, is scared of the intensity of the relationship. And we have to ask ourselves this question. You know, everyone is looking for spiritual growth and so on, but how prepared is a person to have that intense lifestyle of closeness to God? As opposed to, yeah, it's nice, makes me feel good, makes me feel close to God, but on my terms, when I feel like it, that's a lackadaisical relationship. A true relationship is the one where there's a commitment 24/7, all the time. Okay? And so the more a person is willing to commit to that intense relationship, the closer it is. And the less that relationship exists, and again, everyone has a growth process of building a relationship. But the reality is, as God tells the Jewish people, if you're not committed to the relationship to the nth degree, neither am I. Let's see how things go. Let's see how things go. If you're not fully committed, I'm not fully committed. That's how it is. To the extent that you are fully committed, I'm fully committed. And to the extent that you are not, I will pull back with equal measure. And that's when things start to go astray. So we'll hopefully continue and see what happens next week, assuming that we have a class next week.